So this is based on using small angle X-ray scattering, which I'll describe very briefly, but turns out to be a tool that's quite useful for looking at changes in conformation of biomolecules. And the main point is it looks at global changes, which most measurements in biochemistry tend to be local, things like fluorescence or NMR and so on, which are much more localized probes. And small angle X-ray looks at the global size and shape. And I'll describe two sets of data. One is data on folding of an RNA ribozyme. This has been done in quite a large collaboration led by Dan Hirschlag. And our group has been doing some of the X-ray work, and Lois Pollack, who's at Cornell, has been doing some the other part of the X-ray work. And Vijay Pandey and Brad Nakatani have been doing some modeling. So I'll describe some of the interpretation of the data based on these models. And then the second part is really a completely different subject, and it's to do with the formation of amyloid. Amyloid is a polymeric form of many proteins, and people are starting to believe that it's a generic. You take almost any polypeptide chain, the side chains don't seem to matter all that much, and you can induce it to form this polymeric structure. And part of its interest is that it's important in certain diseases. Biology is very good at getting rid of these polymers. The cells have a very complex machinery to do that, but when it fails, there are diseases that result. And this work's been done in collaboration with Stanley Prusiner and Fred Cohen's group, and I'll describe some of that work in the second half. So the technique that we use to get this data is extremely simple, and from the point of view of a physicist, it's simply a measurement of an X-ray form factor. And so this is very old. It's been going on. Well, it was developed as a fairly quantitative technique in the 1950s, mostly by Porod and Kratky. But at that time, X-ray tubes were not terribly powerful, so it was difficult to do measurements on a rapid time scale. And nowadays, with the synchrotron, we have a 10 to the fifth or more increase in X-ray flux on a sample, and so you can get data quite quickly. The measurement is extremely simple. You simply monochromate the X-ray beam, put it through the solution of the protein, and then measure the scattering on an electronic counter of some kind. So you don't need crystals, but well, there are a number of technical things that make this more difficult than crystallography, and also the amount of information you get is rather limited, but I'll show later in the talk that actually it's less limited than was believed earlier, in earlier days. And so you simply, the first thing you see when you do a measurement like this is that it looks like a Gaussian. This is a very old result, dating back to Debye and others, and the main point is that the width of the Gaussian goes inversely as the radius of gyration. And this is a neat thing because you don't have to use any model to interpret it. In other words, the radius is a model-free result and depends only on the X-ray wavelength. And the X-ray wavelength, so you can think of it as like putting a ruler, X-ray wavelength being on the scale of 1 angstrom. You could put a ruler across the molecule. Unfortunately, there are actually technical difficulties in measuring this for some things which we'll come to in a second, because with RNA it turned out to be rather tricky. Okay, so the radius comes out immediately. What you're really measuring This is still an approximation, but it's quite a good approximation. You're measuring the pair distribution of electron density, so the atom-atom distances are the histogram of atom-atom distances you can think of this P of R function. So it's just a pair distribution function. And if the molecule is dilute, the interference between different molecules can be ignored, and then you're measuring the intramolecular pair distribution function. Again, it's spherically average, so you might think that there's rather, you know, all the information has got jumbled up, but I'll show later that we can miraculously disentangle it for some systems at least. For the first part of the talk, we're going to be looking at RNA folding, and there the important questions will be, can we distinguish the fully open state of the RNA from the different degrees of folding? And there, the very useful way of presenting the data is to use Kratky's observation, which was that if you take a random coil, or just a disordered chain, basically, you could think of this, the scattering factor from this, as being the scattering at intermediate wave vectors. It's the scattering from each persistence length of the chain. Since the chain is disordered, each persistence length is randomly oriented relative to the other persistence lengths. And 1 over k, then, is sort of the Fourier transform of a rod. So what you find is that intermediate k, at small k, you get the Gaussian we just mentioned. At intermediate k, you get this rod-like scattering pattern. And if you multiply by k squared, the square of the scattering angle, your scattering pattern will actually go up. And that turns out to be a very useful indicator of random coil, at least qualitatively. On the other hand, if the molecule is compact, then Porad showed a long time ago that you're dominated by sort of surface scattering effects for this compact object. And the intermediate scattering falls off as 1 over k fourth, so not as fast as exponential as the Gaussian, but quite fast. And that actually turns out to limit the resolution that you can achieve, because if you want to double your resolution, you have to have 4 times the scattering power. And that turns out to be a practical limitation. At larger k, you start to see internal structure of the molecule. So this is an intermediate k. and what I'll show in the second part of the talk is that, in fact, this pair distribution function contains a lot of information that we can extract by an algorithm which allows us to reconstruct a three-dimensional anisotropic density map from a one-dimensional spherically averaged measurement, which is quite remarkable, actually. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, these are small objects, so the surface, even though the surface is important relative to the volume, it's not. Porod's law is sort of for a plane surface, really. So it's an approximation. It doesn't really go as k to the fourth, but it goes in that general direction. So it's not quantitatively been, you can't really use it directly. Okay, before I go to RNA, I just want to show a little bit on the protein work to contrast what comes with the RNA work. So we've done a lot of work on lysozyme. Lysozyme is a small protein, 129 residues. It's sort of got 2 pseudo-domains, an alpha helical region and a beta sheet region. It has a number of disulfide bridges which prevent it really opening up into a random coil. One of the main reasons people study this is it comes from egg white and it's very cheap. So if you're a physicist, you could buy it easily from Sigma and you don't have to worry about doing biochemistry. And basically enough, I've talked to the people in the field who publish on this that they all agreed that they started on it because it was easy to get. So, but it's quite an interesting small protein. 129 residues. So just to show you a bit of an idea of time-resolved data, this is data of folding of lysozyme, and what we do is we take the lysozyme and dissolve it in guanidinium hydrochloride, or we could also use urea, and that causes it to get into a denatured state. Now, the radius of gyration the unfolded state has a radius of gyration of 22 angstroms, and actually that's rather small for a protein of this size. If it was truly random coil, you might expect it to be more like 40 angstrom, and that's because of these sulfur bridges that don't let it unfold completely. Nevertheless, it definitely becomes highly disordered and at high guanidinium. Now, the point is that if we take this exponential plot and extrapolate back, it looks like it's only going to be 19.6. And what's happening is that there's a very rapid change, faster than a millisecond, that hasn't yet been resolved. The earliest time we could look at in this experiment was around 10 milliseconds. It's around 11, actually. So this is a case where you have a protein that's denatured. As soon as you mix it with buffer, it's in a bad solvent. When it's in the guanidinium, it's a good solvent. So from the polymer point of view, it's random, although, as I said, it's not really a random coil. But as soon as you add buffer back in, you go below what you might think is the Flory condition, and then it tends to want to collapse. And well, okay, I'll say a little more. We've used two different mixing devices, and in the RNA work, we've got a third mixing device, the jet mixer. So what we did to get below 100 milliseconds was to use a jet mixer. What happens is you mix at very high pressure, about 300 psi, the protein and the buffer in a very small turbulent cavity a few microns across, and then this stream of mixed material comes out at high velocity. That's why it's called jet. And then the X-ray beam is placed at some distance from the jet nozzle, and depending where you are at the time of that it took to get to you, could be as low as 50 microseconds in principle. However, this... well, it's to do with X-ray intensity. There's just not enough photons to count good statistics below 100, roughly. But it's about... well, in our machine, it's maybe between 5 and 10, but we can't see it anyway. But with the jet mixer, you could get, in principle, back down to 50 microseconds. But again, the X-rays are not very intense, relatively. And so the fastest we could get was around 10 milliseconds. And the problem is that to get fast, you have to push a huge amount of protein through the jet. And protein's expensive, so as I said, lysozyme was cheap, but even there we used grams of the stuff to get this picture. So turns out that it's quite difficult to go below. Some of the improved synchrotrons, like the one at Argonne, Advanced Photon Source, and the one in Japan, Spring 8, have potentially a much higher photon flux. We tried to use one, and so far we haven't succeeded, but the point is, it probably will be possible to go to shorter times, but we already know from our optical work, UV fluorescence on this protein, that the mixing time is below a millisecond, and so most instruments can't really see, the collapse time. So it collapses from 22 angstrom, and here, you know, if we extrapolate this fit that we've done here, which is a slower exponential it's already collapsed. So in this particular protein, it collapses, and then you could see that at longer times, there's a second process. And the kinetics of this was worked out some time ago by Chris Dobson, but this measurement actually allows us to see a bit more detail than the if you didn't have the X-rays. This was done in collaboration with Thomas Kiefhaber, who has a way of doing interrupted refolding, and so the kinetics actually is quite complicated. So what you have is your denatured state, which in principle is a random coil. You remove the denaturant in some device, like the ones I just described. There's some kind of a collapse, and in our case, we could measure details about this collapsed state from the X-rays. And then there seems to be a parallel pathway that Kiefhaber first worked out using optical methods, where it could either go directly to the native state or through an intermediate, where the characteristics of the intermediate are that the beta domain of the protein seems to be disordered, while the alpha domain seems to be ordered, qualitatively speaking. So there is a relatively long-lived intermediate where part of the protein is still disordered. And the point I really want to make here is that apart from this intermediate, and this, by the way, this whole kinetics is strongly pH dependent, and the measurements we were doing where we did both lower and intermediate pH. But the main point is that there is a direct, from this non-specific collapse state, a direct pathway straight to the native. So it's, in that sense, it's sort of two-state. There's a, once it's collapsed here to this non-specific, it's, I won't call it a molten globule because it doesn't exist in equilibrium, but this non-specific collapse state, there is a, it's a, it has two-state folding. It doesn't, you know, it doesn't stop on the way long enough to observe anything other than the direct transition to the native. As I say, there is this other intermediate that's longer lived, but depending on pH, this may be more or less populated. Well, simply that from NMR measurements, they could show that there isn't secondary structure formed, at least at some level of accuracy. I beg your pardon? No, they're always kept intact at this experiment. It is possible to, you know, reduce them and break the bonds, but that's in this experiment we don't do that. Well, it hasn't really been worked out in detail, but it does allow you to expand the thing up then, but then it's much harder to refold back to a native state because the bonds could get misconnected. Okay, so what I was trying to emphasize here is that although it's a relatively complex thing, the basic folding is fairly simple from this collapsed state to the native state. Just one other protein that was mentioned yesterday by David Baker, and this is the work done with Kevin Plaxco and David. This particular one is interesting because it's a two-state folder and it doesn't collapse at all by various measurements. The data is pretty noisy, but you know, at least we were able to convince ourselves that if you measured the radius in the denaturant and then measured it again in this kinetic experiment, it didn't change. In other words, the extrapolation back of this single rate constant for folding, so it's a two-state folder, it just has one folding lifetime, and the extrapolation back was more or less the same as what you measure in equilibrium when it's unfolded. So this is an even simpler case where you just have a direct two-state folding And most of what David Baker was talking about yesterday, exactly meaning with error bars. It's a small protein, doesn't scatter very strongly, and just it's signal to noise. There's just not enough photons. And I think we did it in rather a hurry, right, Kevin? Yeah. There's just photon counting statistics, that's all.
No, I'm interested in X over there.
Oh, well, okay, I mean, it gives you a rough idea. It's worse than 10%, so it's not a very precise result. So I can't, you know, this is the square of the radius, by the way. So, you know, you could argue that it's not really convincing, but... something like that. So, not super accurate. But at least there's no evidence for multiple intermediates. Okay, let's now look at RNA. And the particular RNA we're looking at comes from this little beast called Tetrahymena. And it lives in ponds, and it's about 200 micrometers long. And the main thing is it's a eukaryote with a nucleus. And this nucleus makes RNA for ribosomes. Ribosomes, you know, the machines that build proteins. But it turns out that this particular RNA has a piece in it called a ribozyme. And this was characterized quite a few years ago by Tom Cech. And it's actually an enzyme made of RNA, and that's why it's interesting. And most of you know that now people have now got the structure of a ribosome, the machine that makes proteins, and found that the piece that does the enzyme chemistry of pulling together the amino acids to make a protein is made of RNA. There are lots of proteins surrounding the ribosome, but these don't come, I think the closest they come to the active site in the ribosome is something on the scale of 25 angstroms. So clearly peptide, the kind of peptide chemistry that happens in enzymes does not occur in the ribosome. And this is a very nice example of a small RNA, relatively small RNA, that has enzymatic properties. And its main enzymatic property is to chop itself out of the RNA that's going to make ribosomes of this beast. Now, why it does that, I have no idea. The biologists I talk to don't know either. So if you read the books on Tetrahymena, they say, oh, amazingly enough, it chops itself out. Not really. I don't think anyone really knows what the reason for that is. So its job is to excise itself out of the RNA chain, and then it folds up. And this is, here's the important thing, and I believe there are a number of talks here on RNA, so most of you have been exposed to this already, but the point about the RNA is that, you know, you have the helical structures made out of the nucleotides, but these are annealed in at high temperature. In making this stuff, you anneal it at 90 centigrade. And so all the secondary structure is made. And I'm glossing over a few details where there's some alternative ways to put it together. But basically, the secondary structure units are formed at high temperatures. And the experiment we do is to take away the counterions, which in this case are magnesium. And when you take away the counterions, the thing unfolds, and you'll see in a minute, it unfolds fairly dramatically. We then do a series of measurements similar to the protein measurements where we measure the scattering from the RNA as a function of time. And now here what I'm plotting are these scattering curves times the square of the angle, the Kratky plots that I mentioned earlier. So here you see this rising form of the plot as a function of angle. which is sort of characteristic of something that's randomly a sort of random coil type thing. Now, actually, when you go into details, it's a little more complicated than that, because the secondary structure units, these sort of blobby things that have been used in the modeling, I'll show you more in a minute, compact objects of around 66 base pairs per kind of unit, and that the X-ray form factor of those are in fact influence the final outcome. But the main point to see here is that we have this really remarkable change in the scattering profile as a function of time, and the one at the bottom is done it statically. So this is a completely unfolded, take away all the magnesium, and you see this rising Kratky plot. So if you looked at the actual scattering factor, it would fall with angle, but at the intermediate wave vectors, when you multiply by the square of the angle, it goes up, so indicating this random scattering that I mentioned. Now we start to fold it, and here we've used it, another
what
mixing.
The buffer you have zero magnesium concentration.
Right.
The buffer suddenly contains some compounds.
Absolutely, yeah. I'm trying to remember. I know that they could do it with and without sodium, and I'd have to look it up. I actually have the paper somewhere, but I don't have it at the top of my head. Sorry. It's a good point. Well, the buffer has counter ions, so what are they made of? And I'm not sure, I'm afraid. Well, the counter, when we're going to add magnesium, see what we do here, from here to here, we add magnesium.
Yeah, but magnesium is divalent.
Yeah, well, we've also done it with sodium, and it doesn't have the same effect, but it does still lead to some collapse, actually. Not folding, but some collapse. The sodium data hasn't really been fully worked out, so I won't show it. Now, to do the mixing in this particular case, we work with Lois Pollack, who's developed a mixing device with Bob Austin and other people. And here, what they do is they have a micro channel that they've etched into a silicon wafer. This particular picture came from a paper where they did it with proteins, but we've used the same device for RNA. You mix it with the buffer, and the point is that instead of turbulent mixing, which we used at the previous experiment, here we use laminar flow, and so we're relying on the fact that this has magnesium in it, and that the magnesium ions diffuse rather rapidly, and so even though it's a laminar flow measurement, the mixing is quite efficient, and they've been able to show that with a number of tests. So and this had to be done at the advanced photon source at Argonne, because this is a rather small channel. It's 100 microns across, and our X-ray beam at our synchrotron is a bit too big. It's actually going to be upgraded, but right now they had to go to Chicago and work with, actually his name isn't on here, but some of the cadets matter, people who run the beamline there. So you need an extra strong X-ray source, but again, by moving, well, what you really do is you put the X-ray beam here, and then you change the mixing rate, the pressure, and so this laminar flow could go faster or slower, and so you could see. The main point is you're converting time of mixing into position here. So this distance corresponds to a time, and depending on the speed of the flow, you'll get different times, and that allows us to get down to a millisecond, and in this case, it's actually down to a few milliseconds, so these are seconds here. This is 5 milliseconds, 8 milliseconds, etc. So you can see already that there's a considerable change in profile here when you go from before the mixing, where there's no magnesium, to the mixing where there is magnesium at 5 milliseconds, 8 milliseconds, and so on. Now, I've put the radius of gyration here. It goes from around 74 when it's not folded up to about 47 when it's folded. But unfortunately, we weren't able to get an accurate measure of the radius in between. So what we did instead was to look at a projection onto of the scattering pattern onto a mixture of unfolded and folded. And this enabled us to get a feeling of how a measurement of how efficiently it's folding. And what you could see, these points up here are the continuous flow mixing, and then after 100 milliseconds we use the stop flow, and it is very noisy, again due to problems with X-ray flux. But you can see that there are definitely at least two steps in the folding, and the fit here was, you know, approximately a few milliseconds, and on the scale of 100 milliseconds. So we can distinguish a sequence of events. Now, again, it looks a little bit like that picture of lysozyme, and one has to convince oneself that it's not going through different parallel pathways, and I'll come to that in a minute. But here's the thing that happens. If you look at longer times, from the point of view of this particular analysis of the data, it looks as though not much is happening. However, if we do a principal component analysis, or singular value decomposition, we could even pick out changes that are going on out here where you can't distinguish them from this simple projection fit. And let me just show you some idea of what happens. If you look at the different components, yeah.
Blue diamond.
Mm-hmm. Oh, this is the, there's a fit to two components in this picture. So the blue diamonds are the folded fraction, and the pink triangles are the unfolded fraction, roughly. So they're kind of complementary, but it's not a simple linear combination. Okay, I just wanted to show you that there's stuff going on at longer times that are hard to see in that particular fit. And these, when we do a principal component analysis using the singular value decomposition algorithm, there's always one component that looks like a Gaussian, so the pictures don't really change much. But when you start digging out these other components, and obviously you'll think this is a very noisy thing, but to the, you know, the eye of the experimentalist, this is significant. This sort of dip here. This one is less significant, but there might be something, and this is pretty noisy. But what I'm trying to say is there are changes going on that are not obvious when you do a very simple fit and you have to do this fancier analysis to see them. This is scattering angle, and this is the intensity of this component. Yeah. So there's that. We actually did four components. I didn't show the principal one because it just looks like a Gaussian. It doesn't do anything. And it's these ones that change.
I have a question. Yeah. Transparency.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the points and I'm looking at the lines.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at
this stuff, you mean?
It seems to be compatible with lots of lines.
Yeah, so.
Where
does that? Okay. I guess what we're showing is that the state of the art is not very sophisticated. But, well, I'll show you in a minute some of the stuff that they did with the fingerprinting measurements that are consistent with this kind of picture.
So you're saying that a single component fit, for instance, that this has been a
foundation
where a single component fit did not work?
Yeah, I mean...
our eyes are so drawn by the blue line that it's hard to just...
Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, no, I think, well, okay. There, I think if you just go qualitatively, you'll see that, really, because qualitatively, they really are different. These early events, you know, still contain a lot of unfolded component. And by the time you get to, 50 to 100 milliseconds, it really has changed. So There's a rapid component and then a slower component. I agree, it's, you know, you have to look at it in more detail. Okay, so what I was trying to convince you of, that there's stuff going on at longer times that is not obvious from this top fit. And this is the second component that I just showed you, and it's consistently changing over this period from 10 to over 100 seconds. So there's stuff going on a much longer time scale that's hidden in the data and needs a better way to interpret it. So that brings me to the interpretation that was done by Vijay and Brad Nakatani. And so what they did was to build a very simple model, and they took the secondary structure units and did an analysis based on what they thought was the flexibility of the different segments. If I can find that picture again. So the model is a blob model, which shown by these blobs, and each blob is around six base pairs. And they place the blobs in a way that the people who look at RNA flexibility felt was reasonable. And so wherever there's where they separate, they consider it flexible.
Two-dimensional structure you try to write.
Yeah. This is
no experimental.
Not directly, no. They don't have a crystal structure, but they know bits of it, I think.
P4, P6 of them.
They knew bits of it, yeah.
And that's not.
Yeah.
The entire consisting of the P3, P7.
So it isn't complicated.
No. This is the expanded state. So no counter ions initially. This is the expanded state. And if they do some very simple Brownian dynamics with this model, it's a go potential. It's well, there's a structure in the literature which is an invented structure, you know. But it's based on lots of evidence which Dave knows a lot better than me, so he could tell you more details. The thing I wanted to mention here was that when we plot, and I don't have the overlay, but when you plot the scattering as a function of angle times the square of the angle, you get a function that looks very, very much like the data. And we haven't really done closely quantitative fits, but the general shape.
And that's no adjustable parameters?
Yeah. That's without adjustable parameters. Of course, where you put the blobs and stuff matters, but it was done without trying to fit them, And you can't see this terribly clearly here, but when we blow it up to the right scale, they do look extremely similar. And this one, and this one here, it has a sort of bump followed by a rise. And then the measurements actually stop around here. They can't go all the way out. But it really looks quite a good fit to the measurements before you add the magnesium. And then what they do is do some simple Brownian dynamics. And so they start with the Coulomb forces switched off to see this very expanded state, the screening. Switched off, I should say. And then they put in screening. So this is unscreened, and it's exploded out by the charges on the RNA pushing each other. And as I said, it really looks very like the data. But now, as soon as you start to allow the thing to iterate, it starts to collapse. The radius comes down. And you start to see this peak. If you remember, I mentioned earlier that once the thing is compact, this Parod law starts to take over. Yeah. Well, no, initially we have Coulomb, then we actually switch the Coulomb off or screen it.
Okay.
So it's screen Coulomb plus Go. Yeah, non-specific, right. So the Go is the important thing. Yeah, right. So the thing starts to collapse, and my main point here is that if you look at the, again, comparison with the data, it really does start to see a peak coming up. This kind of a peak here, and that's you're seeing this it here, and so we can actually see a number of snapshots. Yeah, no, it's true. It's not at this point, you know, we haven't really analyzed the calculations in great detail, but it continues to evolve as a function of time, and eventually it reaches this native-like state. And as we were saying earlier, we don't have a three-dimensional crystal structure of this molecule, so this is being inferred by a number of knowing crystal structures of fragments.
Is it possible to create iterations on the
x-axis? Well, that's not clear at this point. It's something we're trying to look into, actually. So the main point is that the X-ray data and this model are at least qualitatively consistent. And then the question to ask really is more details of that we haven't done, but I think the data contains the potential to see more of the details by this principal component analysis. And this is some of the data from Sarah Woodson's and collaborators, where they actually see different segments that come together at different times. And this is where they do fingerprinting of which pieces of the chain are exposed at different times in the folding process. So they produce hydroxyl radicals, footprinting they call it, not fingerprinting. So they produce these radicals which attack the exposed pieces of the chain. They can then, by a complicated set of chemistry and running things on gels, see which pieces were attacked at which times. And so they've got this scheme that they've developed of the different steps of the folding where these different pieces come together, P4, P6, etc., all the way to the folded state. Now, the thing to notice is that the time scales actually are rather different. the measurements were done on this footprinting technique, we're down at 42 centigrade, which actually folds about 10 times faster than the measurements we did, which were at 15. So we did them at lower temperature, partly to make it slower, and therefore the X-rays could see it better. But nevertheless, I think the X-rays are suggesting that, so there's a whole series of events that go on for very long times, and the functional form, you know, even though it's collapsed, it's still rearranging on this long time scale. And that was the main point of that little picture I was showing, that there are still changes of the X-ray structure going on, which are subtle, but I think they're real. So I think that this kind of, where are we? You know, these kind of scattering pattern details may well correspond to some of these rearrangements where the thing actually looks, if you measure the radius, you'd hardly see any change, but the scattering pattern has more subtle details which may reflect some of these changes they see in the footprinting technique.
So, yeah. Subtle,
yeah.
42 degrees is not 15 degrees.
Yeah.
And there are experts in polyelectrolytes sitting in this room. The dielectric constant changes. There's a temperature dependence associated with dielectric constant. The possibilities of counter-ion condensation and things like that, which would be very different in 42 and 15.
Uh-huh.
So why do I have to make the similarities and then
Well, okay. No, I mean, from the point of view of the footprinting, they're gross changes. From the point of view of the x-rays, they don't show up. The thing looks as though it's already reached the compact state. The only point I'm trying to make is that there are changes going on that we can see, which are just not that obvious. You know, in that sense, obviously the footprinting is giving us a lot more specific details, and this is just telling us something about the global changes, and the global changes are not very obvious at these long times.
My point is that the
well, I think you're probably right, yeah. Okay, so let me just put up my conclusions about RNA folding. Is that well, first of all, the collapse is defined by the counter ions. It does seem to have a whole set of multiple intermediates, and that the changes in shape are what I was calling subtle. Not much seems to be happening, although it's not functional until quite long times on the scale of minutes. I didn't mention kinetic traps, but depending on how you prepare the RNA, it can get into a very long-lived misfolded state. The proteins are, from my point of view, extremely different beasts. The secondary structure really doesn't form stably until it's stabilized by the cooperative folding, coupling between different regions of secondary structure. And an awful lot of proteins are either two-state or, as in the case of lysozyme, have a large two-state component. So it doesn't seem to be that there are all these intermediates that are going on for long times that we see in the case of RNA. It's either unfolded or folded. And so I think the dynamics of how proteins fold is extremely different from the dynamics of how RNA folds, and I think the measurements help pin that down a bit. So now I'd like to move on to my second topic, if I may. Yeah, sure. Yeah, okay.
We'll make it 10 minutes break.
Good.
Second
talk, okay. So the thing is about protein misfolding now is that if you could take proteins in very dilute solution and you fold them up, most of the time you're lucky enough they don't stick together, although often they do, which is a difficulty for experimentalists. But if you start to put them in higher concentration, then in the cell, for instance, the typical concentration is something like 300 millimolar, extremely concentrated. So in the cell, the tendency of proteins to stick together is very high, but there are all kinds of machinery to prevent that. Chaperones, and then there's a whole complex machinery for misfolded proteins, which the chaperones can't refold, that disposes of them, basically gathers them together and puts them into a garbage disposal unit called a proteasome. So there's a very complex set of machines to prevent you getting these diseases. But so in these diseases, you get protein aggregates that all seem to have a common structural theme, which is nowadays called the amyloid structure. And just the familiar ones, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's is very recent, but there is evidence of amyloid involved in Parkinson. They don't know, there's very little actually known about that particular disease at the molecular level. And then the ones I'll talk most about are the prion diseases, which are very old in sheep, dating back, I think, to the 1830s. And then the cows, of course, is nowadays a big deal due to them eating bone meal made from sheep. And then in humans, it was known since the 1950s from this group of people in South, I think, Indonesia somewhere, which had ritual eating of the grandmother's brain. and the disease was called Kuru. And then there's also sporadic Creutzfeldt-Jakob, which is very, very rare. I think it's on the scale of 1 in 1 million in the population. But the interesting thing about these diseases is that once you get them, they kill you. There's no avoiding it. Once you get the symptoms, it's you're gone in 6 months. Your brain is completely filled with this plastic. So, you know, they're actually not very pleasant diseases. Now, the interesting thing about, of course, the prion disease is that they're transmissible. And this was known, I think, well, the first literature on that that I'm aware of is in the 1960s. In Britain, where people had done experiments of inducing the disease in mice, and then studying, you know, the nature of that induction, which I'll mention in a minute. So it's not particularly new, but the work of Prusner and his group has been, over the years, well, what they say is that he went from heretic to saint in about 3 years, but it took something like 20 years of being heretic before. Well, in the variant CJD from the British beef, the incubation is about 15 years. But the problem is that there's 80 people have died of a variant CJD. Variant is the kind that could be associated with the cow disease. Of that 80, they're all homozygous in a particular gene. So the worry is that if heterozygotes, maybe a much longer incubation period, but it's a much bigger population too. So there's a very real fear that the numbers could go into the tens of thousands. Well, I mean, the gene that does the that makes this prion protein is known, and the exact details of this homozygous I don't know, but there's various familial forms where there are known to be mutations that are characterized. So we do know something about the mutations. Yeah, so there, I'm afraid I can't give you the details, but I assume that's homozygous for a particular variant of this prion, yeah. Okay, so what we're seeing is that this amyloid polymeric form of protein seems to be happening in many cases. There are actually something like 50 known diseases which have amyloid, but most of them aren't brain. They're in other organs and tissues of the body. And so what can we say about amyloid as a generic thing? Well, there's quite a large amount of work being done on it. But unfortunately, very little is known at the structural level. So this is a very rough scheme. What people have done is to use electron microscopy and also X-ray fiber diffraction. Now, the main thing about amyloid is very insoluble, so you can't crystallize it. But people have been able to make fibrils in test tube in vitro, and then you can orient this mass of fibrils, either in a large magnetic field or other ways, and so that you can get fiber diffraction. And the most characteristic feature of this fiber diffraction is that you can see a characteristic beta sheet spacing, which extends over many hundreds of units, cellular units. So it's a rather sharp line in the fiber diffraction pattern, showing that you have, you know, long-range order in one axis of the fiber itself. And so this has come to be called the cross beta structure, where it's believed that you have strands of beta sheet that are adjacent to each other and hydrogen bonded. And there's quite an interesting example in a single organism, the beta helical structure. This is from a bacteria, but this gives you an example of such a... So here we have actually a helix winding around in which it's stabilized by beta sheets. And people have used this to try and build models of Alzheimer and other diseases.
Number of beta sheets
Well, and the interesting thing is each amyloid is specific to one protein. So if I try and, you know, a given disease will not involve two proteins, it'll over involve one protein. Well, it varies, but you know, you can convince yourself that that there are individual protofilaments, they're called, which then assemble together. And there's very nice atomic force microscope pictures of some of these where you can actually see them winding around. So there seems to be a helical assembly.
So
Yeah, because you could take things like silk or this bacillus thing and convince yourself that that is the spacing, the canonical hydrogen bond generated spacing of the beta sheets. Yeah, but there's still a lot of argument, you know, is it parallel beta sheets, antiparallel, what happens at the ends, you know, like here, this was a possible model came out fairly recently of Alzheimer, you know, A beta it's called, and where the different residues are located. But, you know, this is all speculation because it's very hard to get detailed structural information. So this is, you know, something that's pretty interesting in the sense that people have shown, even with Dobson's group showed that with a SH3 domain like the one David Baker talked about yesterday, a little bit of gentle denaturation will cause fibrils to grow, and we've also done similar experiments, and I think there's been quite a few. So it seems to be something which is almost generic to the peptide backbone of proteins. And you know, the side chains could stick out of the side, but the backbone seems to be able to form these beta sheets. So no matter whether it was an alpha helical program protein to start with, there seems to be a good possibility of it converting into this polymeric beta sheet arrangement.
How many beta sheets are if you particle domain the fibers?
Across, well, that varies, you know, depending on the specific protein. I'll show you in a minute with the prions, we think there's six. There's another one called transthyretin where it's believed to be four. So that does depend on the protein. Okay, so now that's sort of many either non-disease related proteins or disease related proteins seem to form this beta sheet arrangement. But I'll now focus more on the prions themselves. And so this is the hypothesis that Prusiner has been developing over the years. But originally, well, I don't know. As I say, back in the 1960s, this was already a thing that had been experimentally looked at with mice. So what is a result of the current thinking is that there's a normal cell surface protein that's on all nerve tissue, and it's nowadays called prion protein, which is a name invented by Prusiner, and his name, of course, begins with PR. So, so PRPC cellular prions are the normal component. And these, I'll show you the structure in a minute, but they have a fair amount of alpha helix and then a fair amount of random coil. These are attached at the C-terminal to an inositol group that goes into the membrane. So they're normally attached to the membrane. There's some evidence that they bind copper at the N-terminal, but that doesn't seem to be directly involved in the disease. It's possible that they have some role to do in copper chemistry, but it's not known. But they definitely bind copper. There's some characteristic oligopeptide repeats of copper binding region at the N-terminal. However, you can cut it off, and it's still makes the disease. So that's not directly related to the infectivity. So if you take this cellular protein and make a either in vitro or an in vivo extract, you could subject it to proteolysis from proteinase K, simple enzyme which could break it up. However, once it gets into this insoluble form, which happens in the brain of these animals or subhumans, then it seems to be predominantly beta sheet, as we just discussed. That also can be seen by FTIR, for instance. There are a number of ways to assess the amount of beta sheet. It still has some alpha component, but the main thing that characterizes it, if you take this piece of brain and submit, put proteinase K, it does not eat it up. So there's a resistive piece that is a characteristic of the same exact sequence. The only difference between in vitro, you can make this now in bacteria by recombinant DNA methods, and that does not have various glycosides on it, sugars, but apart from that, it's identical. And but the main thing is, so the same exact protein in the two cases, one is resistant, it's called the scrapie form, SC, the other is not resistant. It's an aggregate, yes. It's insoluble and it's resistant. Yeah. So the hypothesis is that, and as I say, this goes back to the 1960s, that this disease is transmitted by infectious particles. And there's evidence that goes back many years, but been reconfirmed, that these might be dimers. And the kind of evidence, as I said, this was done back in the 60s. You take the brains of these animals and then you subject them to ionizing radiation to try and destroy the infectious particle. Then you inject that brain into another animal to see if it's still infectious or not. And these dose response curves, apparently it's typically used in looking at viruses to see how big the virus is. If it's bigger, it'll be more susceptible to the ionizing radiation. And so the conclusion is that this is probably a dimer. And this is
minimal unit.
Minimal unit, yeah. So that's not a proof, but this is one of the pieces of evidence that it's not a virus. That's the important thing. So, yeah.
So I think a dimer is not that much bigger than a monomer.
Right, yeah.
And so it means that the resistance to proteolysis is not based upon having large aggregate. It's based upon sort of a thing to obstruct it. It's because the dimer form has to be resistant in order to
Yeah, that's not obvious. I'll show you in a minute that the actual dimer itself, no one's succeeded in isolating it. It always forms bigger oligomers, actually.
Are there any other moderately sized proteins that have the same resistance to proteolysis?
I don't know. I think, these are all done on brains, so they're obviously aggregated. So you're making a good point. I don't know the answer. But
another point is that from the cellular is highly susceptible to the proteolysis, unusually susceptible to the proteolysis. The normal form is proteolyzed faster than the normal.
Yeah, but that could be because part of it's random coil, it's not very tightly folded. Yeah. So once the sequence is known and the ability to make this stuff artificially in bacteria was established, then we could start to speculate, and this was a speculation due to Fred Cohen, one of his students, around 95. So here's the NMR structure, it's been redone if anyone's interested. There's about five of them in the protein data bank, so it's easy to look at on RASMOL. But the NMR structure shows two well-defined helices at the C terminal, and then there's a third helix that may go away in the beta sheet form. This is a pure guess, and the current thinking is it's probably not a very good guess. They're actually busy changing the model. But just to give you a schematic of what might be going on. So from the things like UVCD measurements, they know that there's still alpha helical content in the scrapie form, and but there's much more beta sheet content, and so this is a guess that the N-terminal piece of the protein essentially refolds into beta sheet.
But that NMR structure is that 142 residue?
That's, yeah, it's the 90 to 241, so it's 151 residues.
90 to 231.
Oh, 90 to 231, you're right. Yeah. So, as I said, this is a pure guess. This is a slightly old NMR structure. The new one has a slightly improved alpha helical resolution, but it's the same, more or less. So what we did was to see if we could do something with X-rays to try and understand this conversion to beta sheet. And this was the work done with people from the Prusiner group. And here's the recombinant. Now, the interesting thing is that so far this recombinant has not proved to be infectious. You can make fibrils from it very easily by doing the right kind of incubation, but it doesn't, it's not infectious. If you inject it into mice, they don't die. They don't get the disease. Yeah, actually you can make it. Now they've got bovine, they have mixtures of mouse and human, they have a whole range of different recombinants. And what we found was that actually it seems to form a relatively stable oligomer, and I'll show you the details in a minute. Again, our analysis was that when we incubate this stuff at around 37, you gradually form the oligomer, and if you incubate it for a couple of days, it actually forms fibrils. So, the kind of evidence we have is that, you know, you measure the X-ray scattering, and it turns out that X-ray scattering is very good at seeing oligomers, because when you scatter an X-ray off a protein, the forward scattering intensity measures the molecular weight squared. So if you have something that's twice as big, there's twice as many electrons, and the intensity, which is the square of the amplitude, goes up as the square of the number of electrons. So, and in fact, we could analyze this plus radius data to suggest that this was a hexameric form. And well, we had to combine. This was. I'll come in a minute to showing you this is more reasonable. But we had to combine that with the radius data, basically, and do a little model fit. And it wasn't six definitively, it just of order six.
Wouldn't the mass spec give us
information? Yes, they have tried mass spec, but so far it's not completely definitive, actually. Okay, and it takes a few hours, and the most, first of all, it's single exponential. That turns out to be characteristic of many aggregation kinetics, and it's not really understood. You'd imagine that you have some kind of nucleation involving many molecules, and that single exponential is unlikely, but in fact, that's characteristic of aggregation phenomena, is to see this single rate constant kinetics. And the thing that was very surprising here was that it seemed to be just one monodisperse, again, using the principal component thing, we could just see that there was only one component emerging. So now what we did was to say, well, can we go beyond just measuring the radius? And so working with Dirk Walter, who was a postdoc in Fred Cohen's lab, we constructed this algorithm where we could reconstruct a three-dimensional density map from one-dimensional X-ray scattering published last year. I emphasize that we're not the first to do this, but we think our algorithm has some advantages over previous work. Just to give you an example, we did this with GROW-EL. Now GROW-EL, some of you may know, is a large multi-protein assembly which his function is to help other proteins to fold. It's a chaperone. And the thing I just wanted to emphasize here was that so our algorithm picks points on a lattice in a certain way that guarantees that it's compact, but it allows the possibility of having holes. So we actually call it a give and take algorithm. So you give some points to the lattice and then take others away in such a way as to optimize the fit to the data. And actually it's really remarkable, because if you look at the data, this is a log plot, by the way, not a Kratky plot. So we have scattering angle here, log of intensity there. The noise is when you blow up high angles, you see this noise. That experimental profile gave us this picture, and underneath is the crystal structure. And you see that it's amazingly, it can see the hole in the middle. This still boggles the mind, I think. So we have a way where there's an algorithm that takes this set of data and spontaneously breaks the three-dimensional symmetry and also breaks the topology. Previous algorithms assumed a spherical topology. Here we could see a hole through the middle in both above and in cross-section. And so we applied this algorithm to our... Well, you wouldn't think so, but if you read our paper, we really tried hard to get multiple results, and we couldn't. Yeah, I mean, the algorithm has constraints of positivity and compactness, which are very important. But, you know, it was a very smooth energy surface. That was weird. It converges rather quickly. And secondly, it didn't seem to have multiple minima that we could find easily, at least. Very weird. So here's our experiment, essentially featureless, and here's our result. It's a three-lobed object.
Is there any way of getting error bars on the structure? In other words, something like the values or some indication of what the possible resolution.
Well, yeah, the resolution is in a way dictated by the lattice spacing we come up with. And what we did was, we did lots of runs over and over again and then superposed them, right? So here's a typical. So that helps you get some feeling of the resolution. But it is mainly dictated by the lattice spacing. This particular case, GROW-EL is a very big molecule, so we needed a big lattice spacing.
So when you get, you say doing multiple runs, so it's just a stochastic?
Yeah. Each time you do it, you know, you have choices to make.
For instance, if you were to add in some synthetic noise, data, and then just see if you
recover the same. Right. Well, we haven't tested it to destruction, I've got to admit. But we have tried it on lots and lots of proteins. Yeah. So, you know, it's not that bad. Okay. So then we decided, okay, this seems to be a three-lobed structure. Is there some way we could build a model that would describe the structure? And so what we did was to take, this is totally arbitrary, I have to say, but so was Fred Cohen's original model, so it's no more arbitrary. So we took the original model and then said, well, supposing we swapped over to make a dimer. Okay, this is inspired by the... idea that the infectious particle is a dimer, right? So we tried to do a very artificial domain swap. So you shouldn't take this seriously, except it gives you dimensions. And when we did that, and then built our model in three dimensions, and superposed it on the X-ray data, it actually, amazingly enough, comes out reasonably well. I mean, there was very little juggling, because we had to agree on the dimer distance. But it actually wasn't very hard to come up with this result. So the red dots are the X-ray structure, and the black dots are the model. And you could see front and side that the dimensions, that's all you could say, really, the dimensions are reasonable. Okay, why would you believe a word of this? Well, yeah, and from the loops, right? Yeah. Well, the two alpha helices, two of the alpha helices are stable. Yeah, and then the others are all, yeah. Right, yeah, that's the model. Okay, so why believe any of this? Well, what happened was that in the same time, Holger Willi, who's a very talented electron microscopist, took actual infected brain and by very gentle separation was able to make, separate out the scrapy part, which is identified with antibodies and things like gold-labeled antibodies, and see that there was actually something looking like a hexagonal lattice. So what he sees mostly are fibrils, but sort of at the ends of the fibrils he'll see regions of two-dimensional lattice that look hexagonal, and then if you do some EM computer averaging, you can actually come up with an electron density map for these helical objects. And so if we take our model now, this is extremely crude, and superpose it on this helical lattice, hexagonal lattice, sorry, we can get some correspondence, and don't take this seriously, but just to give you a feeling that the same objects that are made out of what we call trimer of dimers, these, if you put these together in an array, they make something that overlays the electron density. However, we did have to change the dimensions. So we had to make the dimer more tightly bound in order to fit. And so the main thing is that there's some evidence then that this the way I think of it is that these assembly of dimers are stabilized by the helical contacts. And the interesting thing, which I don't have a picture of, but more recently they've made a dilution mutant where they took out part of the of this region of the chain that's not helical. It's called the 106 mutant. It only has 106 residues. And it forms the and they managed to make transgenic animals which had disease from this mutant. And the electron microscope look identical, except of course there are missing density where the deletion occurs. So that gives extra evidence that this kind of stabilization by the alpha helical regions is a reasonable model. So so the idea then is that maybe if you stack these things up on top of each other, and here Melissa Misalich, one of Fred's students, is working on actually looking at improved representation of the beta sheets so that you could get stacking, and then this could be the basis of a fibril, or maybe arrays of these could stack up. So mm-hmm. Right, it could. Well, okay, except that the electron microscope seems to show evidence of monomolecular layers. Now, it doesn't mean that those are the things that stack, but they are in the same view as a fibril, so somehow they seem to occur together. Why? We don't know. But. So the main conclusion then is that that it probably forms hexameric particles. That the hexamer size in the non-infectious form is actually bigger than if we try and use the same model to fit the electron microscope scrapy form. And I believe that's evidence that the scrapy form is a tighter fold, and therefore it's harder to make because it it's believed by Prusner's lab that this actually has to be made by a special chaperone. The scrapie fold is not something, you know, everyone's tried to make the infectious particle artificially, but they have not succeeded. I'm just looking for my hypothesis slide. So the idea is that there's some kind of chaperone involved in conversion, so that the infectivity could involve, you know, a scrapie particle from outside triggering the conversion of a native one by some third protein X chaperone. It's still wide open. There's some evidence from the transgenic mice where they do a lot of variants of the sequence, some variants are more susceptible than others, and it's a complex problem. But I don't think so. No.
The wild type is not the transcript. The transcript of phosphorylation.
No, the glycosylation. I don't know about. Not phosphorylation. I don't think. Yeah, there's glycosylation of the wild type, which is not in the recombinant. Yeah. But, you know, in these constructs, the 106, I'm not even sure if the disease form is glycosylated. There, I don't know the answer, I'm afraid. Yeah.
You mentioned that this construct is not the entire particle.
Right.
How does that work in terms of your model, in terms of why this is not an infectious?
Well, my feeling, you know, my guess then is that it folds in some way that is stabilized by the alpha helices, but where the particular interlinking of the beta sheet part hasn't been triggered. You need to trigger that, and that our evidence suggests that it's more tightly bound in this scrapie form than in the recombinant form. Yeah. Oh, 15 years is simply because the first human cases were. No. That's in the British beef. The British beef. Yeah, right. Now with mice, if you expose them if you inject into the brain, it takes about 60 days. If you expose them to in less direct ways, it could take 300 days. So there's an incubation period in mice that's been worked out in detail. So they have some idea of how long it takes to. Well, you see, incubation in an animal has nothing to do with incubation in a test tube. This is quite interesting. When you try and make amyloid with all kinds of things, not just prions, there's always a lag phase that appears to be a nucleation phenomenon. So it's as if you had to form some kind of a nuclei, which might be these oligomers, we don't know, but there's some force microscope data that suggests that you have to first form oligomers, and then the fibrils will grow out of those. So there's always a lag phase to form these oligomers, and then you get a growth. So the incubation is to do with this lag phase.
That piece of it is very similar to Lilly and sickle cell mechanism. But also you have a lag phase growth.
Right. I mean, this seems to be rather general in these aggregation phenomena, actually. And if you take the fibril and inject them into something that doesn't have any fibrils, they'll grow without a lag phase. So.
How does that rate of fibril formation depend on concentration?
Well, that's a very complex question. It's hard to measure. And it seems to be rather low dependence, actually. In other experiments, particularly people at MIT, what's his name, George, people know the light scattering, George Benedict's group has done some very nice studies on other amyloid problems, and they say that there's a critical concentrations below which it doesn't form fibers. And, but above this critical concentration, it's not very dependent on concentration. But the temperature dependence is very interesting. If you try and fit it to an Arrhenius plot, you get on the scale of 30 kcal barrier. But if you try and unfold a single unit of this prion, it's 4 kcal. So clearly, it's not, the barrier is nothing to do with simply unfolding the protein. That's not the issue. It's presumably due to the complicated search, some kind of entropic barrier, probably.
But still, if you unfold amyloid prion, and then refold it and go into
Yeah.
What will happen?
Well, that, you know, first of all, it's not infectious. So if you, as soon as you take the brain stuff, even though it's nice and pure, unfold it and then refold it, it loses infectivity.
Would it return to
prime
PC
or prime PSC? No, if you refold it, it'll return usually to the fibril form. Yeah, I mean, I don't know the exact details.
Urea does resist ligation. This is also from your friend's work that you showed last year.
Well, now the main point is that as soon as you unfold it, it loses this infectivity. That's the main point. Yeah.
But the
new lesson with
urea.
But it's not infectious in any case.
Yeah, no, if you take the brain material, unfold it, refold it, no longer infectious. Exactly. That's
if you grow amyloids in vitro, it's again non-infectious.
Well, so far in this case, yeah. But we're still hoping that maybe one of the mutants will.
And
we don't know.
And nobody was able to show in vitro that when you add those diamonds or whatever that
nobody.
That's a major puzzle there.
Yeah, absolutely. And so what I'm concluding is that this provides evidence that the scrapie fold and the spontaneous fold are different. Okay, we knew it's different because it's non-infective. No, they're both beta. You know, the recombinant forms beta as well. Yeah. The scrapie fold seems to be a more specialized, tighter fold than the recombinant fold. So that's the main conclusion.
Can one rule out that still there is some DNA present?
Right. Yeah. I think there's. I've been to many, many group meetings at Prusner, and this hypothesis seems to be consistent, but doesn't mean it's right, obviously, because they haven't really proved it.
Of course, in yeast.
In yeast, it's proved, sure. Yeah, but not in mammals. So, okay, that's the end.